It's Thursday. That means Zach Osterman joins us in the Crazy Horse Tavern Happy Hour. Here we are on the 13th day of July. We recorded this a little bit earlier today. Osterman is busy with family, but he will give us some time this afternoon so we can get caught up on all the big things making news in the world of sports. Good afternoon, buddy. How's your summer?
Can't complain. How about you?
Well, I know I'll be watching the weather in real time a little bit later today, so we're trying to get the semifinals of the Bloomington Baseball League at Winslow in tonight. A big semifinal matchup between the Curry Chevrolet. Well, we don't have a nickname. Curry Chevrolet in Midwest Color Printing. So that's on the docket until Mother Nature has otherwise. So we're busy in that direction. It's post-holiday. The next thing on your things to do besides hanging out with your family, Big Ten Media Days, that won't be this week, but it'll be 2 weeks from today. That's up in Indianapolis. I saw the Big 12 has stuff going on today, so that's kind of the unofficial official summer Claxton that summer is ending, so that's reality. And we know the August 2nd day, first day of school for the MCCSE, that's right around the corner. So we're all in it together. We had some media opportunity today with Trey Galloway, Indiana basketball. We've had a couple of these over the actual summer, since June, somewhere June started. So guys are back. We heard from Trey today. So that was interesting. We'll get to that. Also, the transfer portal, the never-ending saga. I'm going to have you help me out with that as a player Indiana basketball was looking at earlier in portal season is now alive and well. And as always, this time of year, somebody floats something about expanding the NCAA tournament. We'll talk a little baseball. How come the Braves didn't have any hits in the All-Star game? What's the matter? You got 400 All-Stars. Can somebody make contact?
It doesn't matter anymore. So, I mean, you know, there's nothing at stake anymore. So
you're right. The National League finally wins. They break the 12-year hoodoo over the American League. And the last time the National League won the All-Star game, I will point out to our listeners, the Cincinnati Redlegs were the Central Division champions in the National League. So we'd like to have a wash, rinse, and repeat. Reds return to the radio here on Friday night. They open 10 games at the Great American Ballpark. Hey, look, it's Milwaukee again. The Brewers one game behind the Reds. The first place Cincinnati Reds after 91 games. So a great way to start. We'll get into the baseball as well. But let's talk hoops, shall we? I always get confused, and you do a great job of helping not only me out, but our listeners out, as the transfer portal turns. Well, there's always exceptions to the rule, and I probably wouldn't even be paying attention to this if it wasn't for the likes of you and then the others following the college basketball scene. But a young man that transferred from Harvard to Tennessee is untransferring and I guess can go back into the portal. Tell me and remind our listeners of his name again, because Indiana was thought to be in that chase at one point. And here he is back into the portal that closed, 2 months ago. How does this all work?
Yeah. So I believe you're talking about Chris Ledlam, who I believe is a graduate transfer, which remember there is no
beginning.
Deadline.
There is no end.
Graduate transfer. All you need to work out is the academic stuff. You know, can you find somebody that can get you on into, because you have to be enrolled to work out with a team. So can you find somebody that can get you enrolled at a certain time so you're able to work with the team and work out and lift weights and, you know, all those things? And can you go somewhere where you're studying something that you weren't studying at your previous school? I don't know if Chris Ledlam had enrolled at Tennessee. I assume he had. I also don't know if, because I've never seen this before, I don't know if he needs to find a graduate program that Harvard did not have or that Tennessee did not have. It's also worth saying the Ivy League does not allow athletes to compete as graduate transfers, as graduate students, I should say. That's why you see like a wave of Ivy League kids kind of come out of the portal every year, is because they can't go back because they finished their undergraduate degree and their undergraduate career. Point is, I don't know exactly how all this works, other than to say I presume that Ledlam, you know, reviewed this plan with someone wise enough to advise him before he did it. One way or another, he is back in the portal. As you said, he was a top target for Indiana at the time. I think it remains to be seen if he would be now. I'd be probably a little bit surprised. I haven't heard much in the way of Indiana reigniting its interest, but you never know, as they do have that one scholarship open. But one way or another, it is obviously kind of one of those, you know, only in the portal sort of stories.
And that's the reason. I mean, I'm looking at your retweet, and On Three Sports said Tennessee small forward Chris Ledlam re-enters NCAA transfer portal. Didn't mention anything about graduate this or that or anything else. So that, well, headlines. We all like to read the headlines, don't we? If he did enroll at Tennessee, why would he be enrolling at this time of year? Do they do summer programs? Is that change his quote unquote eligibility?
I'm sure he did something. I'm sure he's been at Tennessee somewhere, you know, somewhere along the way here. Again, I don't know what the mechanism is. If he's, you know, maybe he hasn't enrolled, I would be surprised, but I don't know what the mechanism is if he has and now he wants to leave. Again, I would presume someone somewhere has said this is doable. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty weird.
Yeah, signed with Tennessee in May, and here we are on July 13th, and out the door we go. So I don't know which part of May, it's not important, but the drama of college basketball, the portaling, the graduate transfers transferring, the portal is open for graduate transfers only. Do I have that part right?
Well, if you're in the portal now, it doesn't matter. May 11th, I think, was the deadline.
Something like that, yes.
If you wanted to transfer not as a graduate transfer, so someone who is graduating from their previous institution and is going to go to a different school and study something different, the way that like Max Bielfeldt and Nick Zeisloft and Evan Gordon, I think Evan Gordon did for Indiana, to use some like sort of pre-portal era examples that maybe kind of give fans a point of reference. If you are a graduate transfer, there is no deadline. If you're not a graduate transfer, if you're an undergraduate transfer, like, for example, Peyton Sparks from Ball State to Indiana or Kalel Ware from Oregon to Indiana, you had to be in by that deadline. If you were in the portal by that deadline and you're still there, you can exit whenever you want, whenever you find a home, whenever, you know, somebody offers you a spot and you take it. If you are not in the portal, if you were not in the portal by that deadline, the only people who can enter the portal now would be those graduate transfers. In terms of being able to, at least in terms of being able to, you know, anyone can declare their intention to enter the portal at any time, but you would not be able to enter the portal in such a way that you would be able to be recruited and signed and go somewhere else, unless you're a graduate transfer, if that makes sense.
It does, and I think we just, again, every week or so we're reminded of how this works out. I saw a stat somewhere. If the season started today, 40 or 45% of people in the portal would not even have a home. So it is interesting in that sense. I don't know who's winning, losing, or otherwise out of here, but if you want freedom of movement, this is about the only way it can happen, and there are rules and regulations you have to deal with. So I guess that's what it is until it changes.
Right. And again, this Ledlam situation is, I think it's fair to say, something that is kind of hard to pin down exactly what's, you know, what's going to happen, or, you know, basically just how all this works, because, you know, quite frankly, this is quite new. But it will be, I guess, fascinating to see this latest sort of wrinkle in the transfer portal, I suppose.
Zach Osterman is our guest. He checks in with us every Thursday. The beat writer for the Indiana Hoosiers, basketball, football, baseball, you name it. He'll do anything for you. At Zach Osterman at eStar.com. And Trey Galloway meeting with the media today. Now, there's not always a ton of interesting things that come out this time of year, because we're really talking about bigger picture items. But we also get a little pull behind the curtain to see how summertime workouts are going. Fans get excited about, as always, hearing how the freshmen or the new guys are bedding in as well. And it was really this time last year, Zach, where Trey Galloway made the leap in shooting the basketball. And I've always maintained the theory that if you shoot it, you shoot it. If you don't, you can improve on it. But we saw in the numbers, we saw in the form that he's maybe the exception to that rule. What did we learn from Galloway today, whether how the program is going along, anything about the kids? Well, there's probably all these we can answer. And how his development as a backcourt senior is going. He's been there. He's the longest tenured, one of the longest tenured players now in the Mike Woodson era. Trey Galloway is a huge piece of this puzzle for the 23-24 season.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know that there's anybody that you look at on this team and you just sort of say, you know, we know what that player is, what he'll do. The closest is probably Xavier Johnson, but I was writing something obviously off of that Zoom with Trey Galloway today, and it occurred to me as I was just looking through some things. If you basically acknowledge that Xavier Johnson only played 11 games last year, and so these numbers are not, you know, kind of don't include him, and they probably would include him if he had played a full season or something close to it. But he only played 11 games. Among players who played, let's say, at least 20 games, Trey Galloway, who averaged 6.7 points per last year, is Indiana's leading returning scorer. Now, again, if Xavier Johnson had been healthy all year, I would imagine he would be Indiana's leading returning scorer, probably in double digits, you know, maybe even 12, 13 points a game, whatever. But my point is, in terms of where we left IU basketball on March, whatever day that was when they lost to Miami, March 19th, I think. Trey Galloway is about as sure of a thing as Indiana's got coming back. And certainly when you look at Galloway plus Xavier Johnson, you know, those two guys have to be have to be really reliable for this team, especially in the first part of the season. Now with Johnson, you know, when healthy, he kind of is what he's been for the last 3 or 4 years, which is a guy who's a high assist creator, you know, high in terms of shot volume created, you know, can get his own offense, can score, isn't always necessarily going to be the most efficient player, though he has improved his efficiency noticeably since he got to Indiana. You know, the sort of player that you can probably peg at, you know, 12 points, 5 assists, 3 rebounds a game, that kind of thing. Just a really solid point guard, essentially. Somebody who, and maybe some of those numbers go up this year. Maybe Indiana puts more on his plate offensively. We'll see. But you can at least get some sense for what Xavier Johnson might be because of what he has been in the last 2-3 years, at least, of his career. Trey Galloway has changed as a player in each of arguably the last 3 seasons, certainly across the last 2. His freshman year, he played about 44% of available minutes. He finished the ball really well, didn't get to the free throw line very much, was 6 of 33 from behind the 3-point line, had a turnover rate of 22.8%, didn't really rebound the ball in any sort of like overly impactful way. His sophomore year, his minutes actually went down slightly. Or at least the percentage of minutes he played went down, but he did get more efficient. He shot, you know, just a little bit. Basically, he made the same number of threes, but on 5 fewer attempts. He was a little bit better assisting the basketball, still had a turnover rate that was pretty high. You know, still wasn't really getting to the free throw line kind of regularly. Last year, as you talk about, he takes this big leap both in offensive efficiency and, I would argue, really cementing himself. I think we saw him in 2022 start growing into this player that really could embrace, you know, big time defensive matchups. Last year, I think, was when he sort of solidified himself as one of the better on ball perimeter defenders, you know, big guard wing defenders in the conference, while also obviously shooting from 3 a lot better. His 2-point shooting percentage went down, but it's worth saying he attempted 27 more twos last season than he did in either of his previous 2 seasons. He got to the free throw line more often. His turnover rate plummeted. It cut by almost 10, or right at about 10%, and he posted career highs in percentage of minutes played, effective field goal percentage, true shooting percentage. So the point is, he got a lot more minutes, like way more minutes, especially after Xavier Johnson got hurt, and still managed to be a dramatically more efficient player than what he was the previous two seasons in college, and that's shooting the ball, but it's also, you know, turnovers. It's also the quality of the shots that he's taking, the quality of the shots that he's making, how often he's getting to the free throw line. I mean, he took more free throws just in Big Ten play last year than he took in either of the previous two seasons. So the point is, you saw a much more efficient Trey Galloway, and at least the beginnings of a really legitimate sort of two-way player in Trey Galloway. Now, if you're Indiana, the challenge is essentially, and you also, it's worth saying too, saw a much healthier Trey Galloway. He only played 45 games across his first two seasons. He only played 20 in his second season, which was Mike Woodson's first season. You go back to that season, I think he ended that season injured. He missed. He missed a couple games in January, and he was playing off the bench, you know, all the way through. Or no, that's 2021. Excuse me. He had two in 2022. He had two long stretches of injury, missed a bunch of time in November and December, and then he missed five more games in February and March. He was much healthier last season. He only missed three games with injury, and he was basically a regular starter by the end of the year. Now, if you're Indiana, you look at Trey Galloway and you say you need to hold on to some of that efficiency, but we need more volume. And that's in shooting, it's in scoring, it's in rebounding. To some extent, it's probably even in, you know, assist to turnover and those kinds of things. And so he's one of a variety of, you know, a wide range of players, frankly, that Indiana is going to be looking at this offseason and saying, how much can we sort of genuinely put on the board that we feel like we can expect from Trey Galloway this season, not just, again, as maybe a role player or somebody who fills some gaps, as he put it today, does some of the little things, a lot of the little things, but as a player who is prepared to kind of embrace that two-way role while scoring a lot more and still doing it fairly efficiently.
And I think that's the interesting point of Galloway's development was when he first got here, he would just catch the ball, put his head down, and just go to the basket. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but there's more to the offensive repertoire that is there. And then after we got to a point, Zach, where it was, okay, they're going to leave him open because he was proficient putting his head down and getting to the rim. Do you think all three of those scoring levels now are ready to explode after 3 years of putting this package together?
I don't know. I mean, I guess my question would be what qualifies as explode? And what I mean by that is we've had this whole separate conversation about the front court. Tyler Tashman and I had a long discussion about this on our podcast this week of, like, you know, you feel like Indiana's got the tools in that front court, but you feel like they're going to go about deploying those players and trying to get offense from those players in some very different ways this coming season. When you look at Trey Galloway, basically, I guess the question I have is, what do you need from him? What, you know, if we talk about, you know, offensive explosion, if you need him to get to a place where he's scoring 14, 15 points a game while still not necessarily shooting 47% from three, but let's say shooting 39% from three, but doing it on 2.5 times as many attempts. He took 65 threes last season. You'd want at least double that if you need him to be a volume scorer this year, maybe a little bit more than that even. You know, that feels like it's maybe asking a little bit too much from him. But if Trey Galloway can be a player that goes from 6.7 points per game to, let's say,
12, 13?
Yeah, I mean, not even that. I mean, maybe 9 or 10. Then, you know, listen, that bridges a gap to Jalen Huccifino's numbers, as an example. And if he can do that while staying efficient, because that's the other piece of this is if he can score a bunch of points, but he's got to take a whole bunch of bad shots to do it, then that doesn't help the offense.
Good point.
And you'd probably rather him just kind of stay where he is from an impact standpoint and from an efficiency standpoint and try to find those points somewhere else. But if he can, again, like, I mean, his overall three-point shooting percentage last year was 46.2%. He made 30 of 65 threes. If he could make, you know, I can't do the math quickly, forgive me, but if that number fell to 38%, but he took twice as many threes, that's still a quality season on balance. And that probably gets him to a place where he is averaging 10 points per game. Because he's, you know, at that point, he's basically making, he's averaging 6.7 points per game this year. He'd basically be making roughly an extra three per game, or maybe an extra, you know, like 75% of an extra three per game, something like that. Couple in one or two more free throws a game, and boom, he's scoring 10 points a game. And my point is, if he can do that while staying efficient and also still being the weapon that he is defensively, then I think you can live with that if you're Indiana, because he's a year older, he's a year stronger, he's a year more experienced, yada, yada, yada. But again, when we talk about sort of what do you, if you're Mike Woodson, what do you think, what do you hope, what do you know? Trey Galloway probably falls somewhere in between think and know what you can get from him next year in terms of, I don't think you look at him and say, boy, he'd better score 17 points a game or we're screwed. That falls into the hope category much more than the think or the know category. But if he can get to 9, 10, sure, maybe optimistically even 11 points per game while staying efficient as he was last year and giving you roughly the same defensive impact, maybe rebounding the ball just a little bit better, then that's a real net positive step forward for him. And I think that's what Indiana kind of needs.
Zach Osterman, our guest, at Zach Osterman on the Twitterverse. Indy Star beat writer talking Hoosier Hoops. Trey Galloway met with the media today, kind of going through and unpacking what he has told us and brought along. Let's stay with him for 1 minute before we get to the kids. Everybody loves, how are the new guys? How are the freshmen? We'll get to that. Is Trey Galloway more, what's the word I'm looking for? Is it valuable? Is he more valuable on the defensive end to Indiana or the offensive end because of the lack of perhaps guaranteed scoring? I don't know how to put that, but where is his value the greatest in your opinion?
I think because he has shown he can be an efficient three-point shooter, it probably starts there, especially when you look at a team that is, in all likelihood, we don't know this, but in all likelihood is going to have to play a little bigger, and you're going to have to rely on some lineups where you're maybe looking at Malik Renu to shoot a few threes. Certainly Kalel Ware, he shot 55 last year, to shoot a few threes. And you're going to need McKenzie Mbako to be comfortable with a certain amount of volume from behind the three-point line. And you've lost, statistically anyway, your two best volume shooters, or really maybe your three best volume shooters. I don't know where you fall on Jalen Husafino. He was 33.3% from three overall last year, but he was 22-62 in Big Ten play. That's 35.5%. That's a really good number for a freshman in the Big Ten. But Tamar Bates took 99 threes, Miller Kopp took 142 threes, Jalen Husafino took 111 threes. Between them, those three guys averaged probably roughly about 36 to 38%. Again, I can't do the math really fast while we're talking. My point here is all three of those guys took more threes last season than Trey Galloway did. And all three of them, it should be said, made more threes last season than Trey Galloway did. Now, Tamar Bates is an example. He only made 7 more threes and he attempted 34 more threes. So Galloway was much more efficient. But all those guys are out the door now, and you've got to find those shooting numbers from somewhere. And you can, I think we've talked about this in the past. You can look at maybe a CJ Gunn and say, yeah, we think you're better than 2 of 24 from behind the 3-point line. But you're probably still not going to see CJ Gunn go from 2 of 24 last year to 63 of 142 this year, which is what Miller Kopp did a season ago. So you're going to be in a situation where maybe the best case scenario for someone like CJ Gunn is, I won't say best case, not absolute best case, but a reasonable best case scenario is that you can get him somewhere like where Trey Galloway was last season, where he made 30 of 65 threes. So you can up his volume, but still keep it fairly limited. You're not asking him to do too much. And he can, he can be a little bit more selective and shoot the threes that feel really good and not feel like he's forcing shots up. And then you can get Trey Galloway to jump to, let's say, 45 of 115 or something like that. And I don't know if that's like, I'm going to do the math real fast while we're talking.
You're okay. Just round it. You're in the neighborhood. That's okay.
Yeah.
This is not a dissertation we're going to go over with a fine tooth comb. You're fine.
I think the other thing I would say about Trey Galloway, when you ask about his greatest impact, I think you can count on the defense at this point. Like I don't think you look at the defense as a maybe with Trey Galloway anymore. I think that when he was healthy in 2021, 2022, he was that kind of player. When he was healthy last year, which was most of last season, he was absolutely that kind of player. And so I don't think that you look at the defensive side of his game and say, can that keep up? Now, you do ask maybe, Is he going to have to trade in some of that for a little bit more production offensively? Because, you know, guys have to figure out how to balance, you know, just basically the expenditure of energy, for lack of a better term. And then that will always kind of go into that conversation. But I think you can rely on the defense with Trey Galloway. And so the biggest thing for him is going to be Indiana needs somebody to step into a volume three-point shooting role. Can he do that at a quality level? If, again, if he doubles his attempts, that's 130 threes. And if you say he can comfortably go down to 49 or to, let's say, 38%, which is still a good number for increasing your volume that much, that's 49 made threes. So can he basically make 19 more three-pointers? And that sounds like a small thing, but it makes a difference in the way you have to game plan for a player and the way you have to account for a player. And it'll be harder on Galloway, too, because teams – listen, you and I are having this conversation. Tom Izzo's not blind.
Right.
Trey Galloway did this last year. And Big Ten coaches will be looking at Trey Galloway and saying, you know, we kind of dared him to shoot last year. There were times where we decided we had to collapse on Trayce Jackson-Davis or we had to collapse on Jalen Hood-Schifino. We just couldn't afford not to. So we let Trey Galloway kind of have his shots, and he hurt us, you know. And like you look back at his single game numbers, Tom Izzo saw him hit three threes against him. He had three in the loss at Michigan State and three more in the win at Purdue. So coaches will, A, be aware that last year they kind of gave Galloway enough leash to see if he could handle this, and he did. And B, they'll look at Indiana's roster and say, that's a guy that probably is going to get more shots, so we have to be more aware of him. So it's going to be harder on Galloway, but the point is, we're also not talking about him suddenly doubling his three-point output. Again, to come back to that number, if he doubled his attempts, which is fairly reasonable if he's going to start and he's going to have a bigger offensive role, to 130 from 65 last season, and he dropped his shooting percentage from 46.2% to 38%, which would still have made him Indiana's second most accurate three-point shooter last season behind Miller Kopp, that's still somewhere between 49 and 50 made threes. We're only talking about 19 or 20 more makes across 65 more attempts. So it's not that it's not like a huge chasm to span here, but it is something I think he's going to have to prove he's able to do.
Zach Ostrom from the Indy Star joining us here in the Crazy Horse Tavern. Happy hour. We'll take a quick timeout. Got to get to Diane Daly's news headlines, and we'll come back. The Crazy Horse Tavern on Kirkwood. Brunch on the weekends. If the weather's a little funky, go inside. Air conditioning, color TV, and great specials on brunch drinks, brunch food, and all the fun that goes along with it. We're back. The Crazy Horse Tavern happy hour on WGCL next. All right, welcome back. No Reds on the radio tonight. Major League Baseball's All-Star break continues. We will have the Reds opening a 10-game homestand. The Milwaukee Brewers are in town. The first place Cincinnati Reds have a one-game lead, and they get 10 in a row at home to start the second portion of the 2023 season. We'll get things started tomorrow night. 6:40 with Tommy Thrall's pregame, 7:10. Is your first pitch. Joe Smith is back tomorrow for hour number one on Big Show Friday before he heads to the Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame enshrinement ceremony Friday night at the Monroe Convention Center. Zach Osterman from the Indy Star is here now, as he always is on Thursdays. Yes, we did record this earlier today, but we're talking basketball. Trey Galloway met with the media today. That was our storyline in part one. Here in part number two, everybody wants to know about all the new guys and how the chemistry is unfolding, and especially the freshmen. Why it's the next generation moving forward, and a ton of new faces this year. So that is perhaps even a more important question. What did we learn, if anything, today about how the gang is getting together and how summer is going, getting the new faces involved?
Yeah, I mean, you never learn too much. It's interesting that Galloway brings up Ja'Kai Newton and Gabe Cupps in the context of their defense and says he thinks that they're both able to defend at a Big Ten level right now. I that may be the single hardest thing for
anyone,
for a freshman to sort of figure out the adjustment to, because there's so many elements to it. There's the physical element, there's the experience element of it, there's the, you know, older players are craftier, they know how to draw fouls and what they can get away with. You've got to figure out how the conference is refereed. And I mean, like, I think, like, for example, like, it's not hard for me to imagine Malik Renew's foul numbers coming down just because he's going to have a year to watch film and be like, I can't do that. They do allow that in the Big Ten. They don't allow that in the Big Ten. And you could say, well, why wasn't he doing that in season? It's like, listen, there's only so many hours in the day. He's still got to go to class. He's trying to absorb game plans. He's still a freshman. Like, you can try to do some of that, but believe me, that's the sort of stuff, that the sort of little thing, you know, when guys talk about attention to details in the offseason, that is the sort of thing that I think is particularly sort of, I don't know what the word would be, like, sort of appropriate for the offseason. But it is it was interesting, you know, just I think somebody asked him a pretty boilerplate question about the freshman, and both Cups and Newton are guys that in different ways have drawn some positive reviews in the last few weeks. And so you wonder if it's possible that, you know, because Trey Galloway he doesn't just say, oh, they're good players. He starts talking immediately about their defense. Well, that's interesting. It kind of raises your eyebrows a little bit. It piques your concern. But again, you sort of feel like you need to see it to believe it. And the other thing too is, you know, you can have guys who say, oh, the freshman really impressed me. Well, that doesn't mean that they're ready to play right away. But what it means is maybe they're ahead of the curve. And so as they go from freshman to sophomore to junior, they're going to accelerate faster in their careers and their impact than what, you know, the average player might do. But listen, again, this is also the time of year. I remember everybody singing Caleb Banks's praises around this time a season ago. And I think Banks wound up having a pretty good freshman year, particularly the way he closed it out. I mean, like, he, you know, I think three of his five double-digit minutes performances came January 28th or later. And in fact, I think four of, like, his five or six biggest minutes performances of the season came, you know, on or after January 28th. But as much as you might see the promise in Caleb Banks and all that, you know, this time a year ago, his teammates were saying he's a lot better than you think he is, and, you know, he's flashed some really impressive stuff. Well, it still took him a while to adjust. And so I think, you know, we may be in that vein a little bit with both of those guys. And then I think the other thing to remember too is, you know, Gabe Cupps is a point guard. Well, for the moment anyway, obviously we say that just because Xavier Johnson got hurt last year. Not that you'd expect that injury to recur, but just to remember those sorts of things can happen. You know, Cupps has a sixth-year senior in front of him, and Ja'Kai Newton is a player that I've been high on since I saw him in high school, but he also spent a lot of last season playing through or sidelined by a knee injury, and so you're trying to figure out where you need to catch him up physically as much as anything else. And so, you know, no fourth-year player is ever going to get in front of the camera and say, boy, these freshmen aren't very good.
Right.
It was interesting, as I said, the fact that he singled out their defense, both of them. But it you know, it's also sort of a little bit kind of that feels a little bit like a senior praising freshman and maybe throwing a little bit of toffee and saying, keep working, keep getting, you know, keep working hard, keep getting better, and you can continue to kind of flatten that curve.
Well, the other part of this is with the freshman that Indiana had last year with Malik Renew. And we don't have to tell you about Jalen Hood-Schifino, how he went. We hope fans all take this in stride and with a deep breath, correct? It's
right.
There's no point in going head over heels just yet. But one thing we do know, the kids at this time in their career, if you are not Jalen Hood-Schifino or perhaps Malik Renew, you're going to get on the court first by playing defense and grabbing rebounds, because it's you'd be a top 20 player if you walked in the door and started making every shot you looked at. So that I can buy the defensive angle. It's easier to contribute there than it is, because you have to play defense every possession. You're not going to put the ball in the basket each possession. So I can see that and live with it. So Peyton Sparks is new. Kalel Ware, Mackenzie Mbako. Did any of those get mentions, or did he just go right to the two?
No, I think today was more of a discuss the guards kind of day.
Backcourt kind of day. So that's interesting, because Mbako, we're hoping, can play all over the floor as well, just not pigeonholed into small forward or power forward or stretch four. That's the exciting part of this team moving forward, Zach. It seems that they have a lot of players for a lot of places, and I don't want to call it positionless basketball, because there are things you have to do, but There's no doubt interest around this program, and there should be, with plenty of new faces and fresh faces, and one more scholarship left, maybe just in case, who knows. It's been an interesting week or 10 days in college sports. Bob Huggins is out at West Virginia, Pat Fitzgerald, and hazing at Northwestern has been going on. What, if anything, in those do we take out of it? It's just when you think everything's calmed down and settled down, it never does it?
No, it never really does. The off season will always, you know, throw up a handful of these. And, you know, I think the more surprising one is Pat Fitzgerald. And I don't know how deep we want to get in the weeds of what happened there. But I do think that was the one that, I mean, when I say the more surprising one, that program felt like one of the more sort of trustworthy programs in the conference.
Immune to such activities.
Yeah, and I mean, listen, Northwestern, and I'm not picking on them, I'm not praising them, but Northwestern has always kind of carried this attitude in athletics of, you know, we don't compromise our values and things like that for success. We do it as best we can while doing it the right way. And that stuff can become very cliche and can, you know, can bend into navel gazing very, very quickly. But having said that, you know, I mean, I read something and I feel bad for saying this because I often do say this, but I can't remember who wrote it. Stuff just passes in front of me with Twitter and everything. But someone who wrote basically just like the idea that Northwestern now has to remove Pat Fitzgerald from the DNA of its football program is almost unconscionable. He was almost certainly the best player in Northwestern football history. He was the heart and soul of perhaps the best team in Northwestern football history. And he is undeniably the best coach in Northwestern football history. And now, you know, I mean, we'll see, you know, I think he's threatening some legal action. I know he's retained a pretty high priced lawyer, and there's all sorts of questions about, well, why was this, you know, I think his argument is probably going to be, why was this suspension enough to begin with? And then suddenly you just sort of following a public outcry, you know, over arguably your mishandling of this as much as mine. Did you feel as a university administration or whatever move to fire me? And I'm not trying to pick sides in any of that, but just more to say, it would be, I guess the best comparison would be like if Bob Knight had also played at Indiana, if you know what I mean, and been
absolutely,
you know, one of the best players in program history, and then had taken a leap to be one of obviously the best coach in Indiana history, and then you'd fired him. And how would you extricate all that? How would you manage all of that? Because like, there's a real argument. Pat Fitzgerald, like I said, is as much as any one person can be, the soul of Northwestern football. And now you almost have to break that up into a lot of individual pieces. It's very strange.
Zach Osterman here talking a little basketball as well. It's summertime, so that means somebody wants to change the NCAA tournament, right? It happens almost every year.
Yeah, I think, you know, as my good friend Ralph Russo from the Associated Press tweeted today, this comes up a lot, and it's not to say there's nothing behind it, but on the other hand,
trial balloon after trial balloon after trial balloon.
The actual obstacles to expanding the tournament are substantial. Like, for example, you don't want to make the tournament too much longer because it starts to drift into baseball season. It starts to run up against the Masters. It has a really nice television window right now. You can't bump it back because the conferences keep expanding their annual calendars, and they're not going to give up their conference tournaments because those are cash cows, and obviously they are exclusive and sort of premier events. So the point is, we talk about this a lot, but the truth of the matter is, it would be difficult to do in the current setting, and I think it's also probably fair to Ralph said this, and I think it's also I think he's probably fair in saying it. A lot of the actual stakeholders in this probably don't want to expand it right now, at least not at the expense of the headache that would come with it. And so my point is
every conference champion is already in. Who else do you want to put in?
I think the tournament will expand inevitably. At some point it will. You know, Division I just keeps getting bigger. At some point either it's going to keep expanding or there's going to be some sort of, you know, Power Five breakaway and they'll do something on their own, whatever it is. But for the moment, you know, this always feels these stories or this – again, as you said, this happens about once a year, and it always feels like the discussion around it and the coverage of it is a lot more breathless, or basically is as breathless as the ultimate sort of prospect of it is kind of toothless. I'm not saying that it will never happen, but I do think that it will be. It would be a lot harder, a lot more difficult, both technically and logistically and politically than people think.
Why can't we just leave well enough alone? there is a theory that states you're either growing or dying, but that doesn't have to be the case. The tournament has expanded. It expanded just a handful of years ago to include, 68 teams. So every conference tournament champion gets in, right? Who are we leaving out that we need to get back in here?
No, I mean, I think that's fair.
Don't you get tired of arguing about the ninth place Big Ten team versus the ninth place SEC team for the final 11 seed? Does that not bore you to death? It bores me to death.
Okay, but we do it every year, so there's clearly a lot of people it doesn't bore to death.
Right, but expanding that, you put all those teams in anyhow.
I don't think that we should. I don't think that we should expand the tournament, to be really clear. But what I would say is, you know, just sort of saying this is the way we do it because it's the way we've always done it is a surefire way to let something go stale. I think you always have to be. I do think there's validity in at least the way that this was described when the NCAA talked about it. I think Dan Gavitt talked about it, of basically just the committee took some time. I think it was the Division I basketball committee. I think it's the ones that discussed it. Took some time to discuss what expansion would look like. I think it's always important to have conversations like that, to keep having the conversations of like, well, what if we did this? You know, like there's one of the most informative, I don't know if informative is the right word. If you study the history of ESPN as a network, one of ESPN's greatest strengths was failure, insofar as ESPN did not punish failure. Like, it encouraged innovation, it encouraged to try new things, and, you know, some stuff worked great. Like, the magazine was launched in like a month. The ESPN radio network was put together in a span of like 60 days. But then there was also the ESPN phone, which was, you know, certainly well-intentioned, and it flopped badly. But the point was ESPN didn't fire people, demote people, excommunicate people when stuff failed. They just kept saying, let's try new things, let's find new ideas. And eventually we'll find ones that work and stick and make this overall product better. I think it's always important to think about things like the NCAA tournament that way. That doesn't mean you should expand it, but I don't think it's a bad thing to keep having those conversations. Because at some point along the way, you may be presented with a situation where you basically have to say, you know, evolve or die. And it's important to keep thinking about what evolution might look like, frankly.